So I'm out here in the Hamptons and I'm looking out on my driveway where I have a sailboat that I bought this year. It's a 25-foot blue racing trimaran, and I haven't come up with a name for it yet. Now I got it. Blue Carbon. What makes a yacht great and why? Who makes a great yacht and how? These are the questions that keep me up at night. My name is Dave Malik, and I invite you to join me and my guests here on the Fog Warning Podcast, where we aim to provide dependable answers to these eternal questions of yachting. With $50 million in yacht sales under my belt, and with the input of builders, designers, brokers, and yacht owners that I trust and value, I'm sure we can add real value to your nautical life. So, I'll sound the fog warning horn, and we will dive right in. If it ain't Dutch, it ain't much. Look, of course, superior product is built by every yacht-building country in the world. There's always the best of the best in every country. But in Holland, I found, as a country, they consistently produce yachts to the highest quality standards of any place I've been. That's why we say, if it ain't Dutch, it ain't much. Started talking about this in episode one, Tom Brady Goes Dutch, about his purchase of a Wire 55, which got a lot of press coverage, coincidentally, after I told the world about it. Today, we're going to dig in a little deeper into this whole ain't Dutch, ain't much thing. Specifically, how this focus came to be for me here at the Fog Warning. What it means to me, what it can mean to you. And then a more general discussion of what it can mean to our industry. And as you'll hear later in this podcast with our interview with a very compelling man named Jason D'Onofrio, what it can mean to the planet. I kid you not. Trust me, I will do my best to connect these dots for you. So as you heard in episode one, it really started about 10 years ago. I was selling Beecham yachts at the Monaco Boat Show. And one dock over for me was an incredible 32-meter yacht built by Moonen. And it just blew me away. The engineering, the style, the fit and finish, just amazing. But what really got me is I just got the feeling they had this unified vision of what they wanted to accomplish, a way of connecting engineering to functional use to real beauty. And that was the day that the Dutch got to me. We just connected. So fast forward a bit, 3 years ago, I decided to go to Holland for a month to explore and understand, try and figure out this whole Dutch mystique to quality yacht building. And I also wanted to see which Dutch yachts I thought could have real traction here for my clients in America. So I rented a little Fiat, and over the course of that month, drove something like 1,200 kilometers in a very small country, to meet with, to visit as many factories as I could. About the Fiat, by the way, that joke that Fiat stands for Fix It Again, Tony, that's not a joke. Anyway, over the course of that month, I think it was in July, I ended up going to some 17 different factories to talk to builders. And after about the fourth or fifth meeting, I saw this real commonality to boat building in Holland. It got to the point when I pulled up to a factory and got out of the car, before I even entered the factory, I sort of knew what I was going to hear already and who I was going to meet, because they're very much family-based businesses. All builders in Holland are small. I don't think there's a single builder in Holland that's splashing more than 40 boats a year. And all of them, there's no conglomerates there. There's no, you know, big corporate enterprises. These are all family businesses. And time and again, Almost invariably, when I walked in the door, who did I sit down with? But a bunch of brothers. Two, three, or four brothers who had inherited the business from their father. And as often as not, he had inherited it from his grandfather. The interesting thing is, among these brothers, I always usually saw this great division of labor. You'd have one guy who was sort of the hand-on builder. You'd have another guy who was sort of the accountant or the CFO, and you'd have a marketing brother. And this is how they did what they did for generations. And let me say, of course, the longest intergenerational story is Hartman Yachts. Hartman, the builder of my Livingstone series and my Admundsen series that you can see and read all about on the Fog Warning website. Johan Hartman, the current owner and builder, is the seventh generation of his family to be building yachts and ships, actually, in the north of Holland. And you can, talking to him and looking at his boats and talking to his staff, you really get the sense how the DNA of 200 plus years of quality yacht building flows to the shop floor today. In the course of my trip, it was very successful. I knew going in that most of the builders boats I was going to see were not really appropriate, let us say destined, to succeed in the U.S. market. There's a certain style and function to most Dutch yachts that are sort of unique to Western Europe. They tend to be smaller, they tend to be slower, they tend to be steel and aluminum on the whole. And they're not, let us be kind and say, not the sexiest creatures that you're going to see on the water on the whole, but they are exceptions. Right? So this is where I first linked up with Zeelander. This is where I was so pleased to discover a line I had never heard of, Long Island Yachts, which you heard about on episode one of the Fog Warning podcast, and now is principal, really, driver of my business plan. And Hartman Yachts, met Johan for the first time. So I was able to select what I thought lines that could succeed. So I'm driving around in my little broken down Fiat, and all these builders are in rural areas. I've been to Holland before, you know, Amsterdam, the sort of tourist thing. Did run some boats, but this was my first extensive exploration, especially in outside of the cities. And when you're driving around there, it was very clear to me that the central truth of Holland is that it's underwater. The entire country, almost, is below sea level. And they've got this incredible technology of dikes and dams and locks to keep the country high and dry, or let us say low and dry. I'm sure back in 1700, 1750, 1650, this technology was state-of-the-art, world-leading in controlling seawater intrusion. And today, as far as I see, it's still state-of-the-art technology. And it's all about keeping the sea out. And when you move boats in Holland, you go up and down canals and then into bays and harbors. And there's a lot of up and down. You have to wait for your entry point to get into a lock. That'll bring you either higher or lower to get to the next boating area. And you get these traffic jams outside the locks, reminiscent of, actually worse than, the traffic jams you see as you're moving a boat down the ICW in America, waiting for those bridges to open. If you go back and read my blog post on IPS drives on the Fog Warning blog, there's probably three separate blogs about this technology. I talk quite a bit about the terrific function they allow, which is dynamic positioning, this sort of digital anchoring, which was great when you're waiting for a bridge to open. Well, you ain't seen nothing till you've seen the lineup at a Dutch lock and these IPS digitally anchored boats. It's just a no-brainer. So keep the water outside. That's what I learned. And in thinking about it a lot over my various trips there and here in America and on my own boat, I've realized that there's a truth there that's so basic. It's just such a fundamental truth that we don't even think about it. It's like, don't think about breathing. You know, you can't live if you don't breathe, but it's such a basic thing you don't think about. Well, when it comes to boats, the most basic thing is keep the water out of the boat. Keep the ocean in the ocean. we know this, builders design and build to do this, but we sort of take it for granted, or we hope it's done well. This is why in my last blog posting entitled No Bad Weather, Just Bad Boats, I spent a lot of time talking about best practices in building, in that case, steel and aluminum boats, and how the integrity of the hull, the secret mission of designing and building these boats, it's not about what steel or aluminum you use. It's how you do the welding. And in particular, how you weld the bulkhead to the forward part of the hull. Because when you hit something, that's what's going to pop. That's basically your whole Titanic story. So driving around Holland, seeing how the Dutch excel at keeping the water out, it really resonated with me here when I come back to America and I'm visiting clients and moving boats around, because encroaching seawater is not just a Dutch thing. In fact, the Dutch do a great job at it, at keeping the seas back. In America, not so much. I've got a client in North Carolina who tells me that out at the Outer Banks, global warming is leading to rising sea levels to the point where out by Hatteras, they're losing 14 feet of beachfront a year. That's incredible. That's just an invasion to me. I have another client, a good friend. He's the former mayor of Miami Beach, still lives in Miami Beach. And when he was mayor, he moved heaven and earth, literally. Well, heaven almost literally, earth literally, to do what he could to contain rising water levels in Miami. I believe they spent, it might have been $70 million on these massive seawater pumps on Acton Road, the main drag in Miami. Because, look, you've been down there during boat show season on a moon tide. It floods. I applaud him for what he did or what he tried to do. In fact, he jokes that on his very first day as mayor, it was a full moon tide, and he had a kayak to City Hall from his home. Look, we've all seen this, right? Florida Keys, the Annapolis Boat Show, right? Either the sailboat show or the powerboat show, invariably, is at a full moon. And you know what the east side of the harbor is like. They got to put down planks. You have to wear boots to look at these boats. Newport. All right, looks like a Newport, another great boat show. You go to the north side of town, the Point, where the original sea captain homes are. That floods regularly. Right now, dozens and dozens of those homes are being raised 3 feet off the ground to save them. So we're under assault. Many of our marine communities are under assault. And this has led me to wonder what can be done. What then shall we do? I think Tolstoy said that. What then shall we do? What then can I do? What can we do to preserve the viability and the quality of our ocean environments and ensure the healthy and enjoyable use of these by us, by our families, by our children, by our grandchildren? I'm a grandfather now. This forces you to think of such things. And when I reflect on that, I have to do some soul searching. You know, for most of my career, I've been doing this 22 years. I've sold big, fast boats, 65, 75-foot flybridge boats, 125,000-pound boats that could do 40 knots with twin 1550 or 2,000 horsepower straight shaft man diesel inboards, you know, burning as much as 150 gallons an hour. And every hour of that burn, carbon is being injected up into our atmosphere. And there are times, you know, when I sit back and feel a little guilty. I have put in or I have contributed to adding a lot of carbon, many tons, up into our atmosphere. And I began to think I needed to, what's the word? Maybe atone is too strong a word, but I needed to address this. And after a lot of thought, I came up with an idea and the name of this and a program, an initiative, if you will, that I call Carbon Neutral Yacht Ownership. I'll say that again because it's a new term. Unless you've been following fog warning in recent months, you have not come across it because I've made it up. Carbon Neutral Yacht Ownership. So what is that? In a nutshell, the fog war will offset any carbon that your boat has put into our atmosphere during your ownership. Let me make it a little more, a little clearer. For any boat that you buy from the bottom, new or used, every year that you own that boat, I will offset the carbon that your diesel engines or your gas engines are putting up into the air. It's actually a surprisingly easy program to implement. All I ask you to do is that at the end of your boating season, you send me the receipts for all the fuel that you use that year. And there are online calculators. They are reliable and easy to use. That'll calculate how much carbon your yacht usage has put up into the atmosphere. And then the fog warning will buy offsetting credits or make donations to carbon absorbing programs and initiatives that will zero out the impact that your boat has had on the environment and what effect that has had to global warming and rising sea levels. So where does this bring us today? Well, you're going to hear in the coming interview about how carbon use can be mitigated. Well, it's all pretty simple. I'm a little mad at myself that it took me so long to figure this out, and I'm really happy to have launched this, but it's really personally just the first step. If you look at the links on the podcast page, you'll see the press that I've begun to get on this. And in the press, much of the coverage concludes with me saying, you know, look, I'm happy to be, pleased to be, the first yacht dealer to offer carbon neutral yacht ownership on planet Earth. But I'm just one guy, right? There's only so much impact I can have. We all have to do what we can, but there's only so much I could do. And what I'd really like to do is to jumpstart a conversation in our industry where more dealers and builders can join, let's call it Dave's Big Blue Wave, to offer carbon neutral dealership to their clients. And look, if a client chooses to buy a yacht from somewhere other than the fog warning, when you're negotiating your deal with them, talk to them about carbon neutral yacht ownership. Encourage them to offer a program like this to a win-win situation here between the dealer, you, the client, you, the buyer, and our marine environment. Help spread the word. As Spike Lee, my friend from high school in Brooklyn, has been known to say, do the right thing. Spread the good word. Have your other dealers and builders call me. I am happy to explain how this all works. So now, please join me in welcoming my guest today, Jason D'Onofrio from the Ocean Foundation, and he's going to speak about their project Seagrass Grow and explain how it works on the ground, so to speak, or along the shoreline, so to speak. I think you're going to enjoy it.
Jason D'Onofrio, welcome to the Fog Warning Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've been looking forward to this. You and I spoke at length last week, and I have a pretty good understanding of what your program does and how I can partner with that in my program. What we didn't cover was sort of the personal side. You know, who are you and what brought you here? Before I was a yacht broker, strangely enough, I was a social worker. So whenever I meet people in the not-for-profit sector or those who work on the side of angels, I'm very curious about your life. So do you mind sharing a little bit of that?
Sure. No, thank you. So the joke with me that I hail from the great ocean state of Arizona. So, you know, not something that I normally grew up with, but, you know, I being born and raised in Phoenix and growing up in the desert, it was weird. I sort of built this affinity for the ocean, not because I had proximity or regular exposure to it, but because when I did have exposure to it, it was almost like this majestic, rare experience. And so I always thought of the ocean as kind of this very special, extraordinary visit when we, you know, the family would either go back to New Jersey and visit where my parents are originally from, or, you know, get in the car and drive to California for the weekend. So I grew up building an affinity, but an affinity from afar for the ocean. It's funny that you mentioned you were a a social worker. That is my mom's profession. So before she retired, she was a social worker for many, many years. So I also have a deep appreciation and affinity for that line of work.
So what is the Ocean Foundation?
Yeah, that's a great question because we're pretty weird. I like our weirdness, but we're weird in the sense that we are a community foundation, the only community foundation explicitly devoted to the ocean and coastal communities.
What is a community organization?
Right. So most people think of a community foundation, they think of a community foundation that is geographically bound. So, like the Arizona Community Foundation or the New York Community Trust or these institutions that are there to facilitate grant making, philanthropic services, and asset management for the betterment of a geographical community. The difference with us is that geographical community for us is the 71% of the Earth's surface covered by the ocean, and specifically coastal communities that regularly interface with it. We were created this way in 2002 in our founding because one of the things we realized is that despite how important the ocean is, right, being the world's largest climate regulator, our largest carbon sink, providing food security to billions of people, I mean, on and on and on, the critical importance of having a healthy ocean ecosystem. Despite all of that, the ocean is one of the least invested, least studied, least resourced places on Earth.
Is that right?
Yes. And even if you think about today, I mean, where are we all going? We're not going into the ocean. We're going to outer space, right?
Right. Okay.
James Cameron, he flirted a little bit, right, with Mariana's Trench. And now Elon's like, okay, let's go to Mars. And all are following suit, right? And I certainly am enamored with space exploration myself. I have that part of wonder in me. But we are not stewarding many of our own resources here on Earth, and the ocean being chief among them. So in 2002, we said, well, how do we help get at solving this? And so rather than structure ourselves as an NGO or nonprofit that focuses on one issue, what if we were a community foundation that helped nurture on-the-ground implementers and practitioners on a host of issues? And so the core part of our operation when we were really founded was fiscal sponsorship, where if you're an on-the-ground NGO, you're a scientific researcher, you're an academic institution, and you know how to do that work the best. You know how to study sharks. You know how to conserve sea turtles. You know how to take these scientific, you know how to do the actual work. You do not want to incorporate as a 501c3 nonprofit. Well, if you don't, it's very, very difficult to get any kind of philanthropic support.
Right, I'm sure.
And so applying for fiscal sponsorship means you now are fiscally hosted at the Ocean Foundation. You can fundraise because we are a 501c tax exempt nonprofit, but you also get all of the kind of back end office, accounting, insurance, contracts, all of the administrative oversight, accountability, facilitation, so you can do the actual work that you know how to do best. And so that really became kind of the core of who we were at our early days. Today, we have almost 50 fiscally hosted projects spread throughout the United States and spread throughout the world. I believe we're on 6 continents. We just had a project end in Antarctica, or we'd be on all 7. and that was really who we were for a while, and still who we are today. But over the years, we also recognized there was a set of threats that were not being addressed, and that the Ocean Foundation maybe was uniquely suited to focus on. And so the first issue we really started doing, very honestly, a year after our conception in 2003, was looking at the issue of ocean acidification, right? This, the changing chemistry in our ocean and how fast our ocean is acidifying. And so we then began to work on that issue and launched our International Ocean Acidification Initiative, which works at expanding scientific capacity to underdeveloped areas to actually give them the equipment they need and the training they need to use it to monitor and understand what's happening, and also working on the legislative level to help inform good policy for mitigation and adaptation techniques.
Why is ocean acidification a bad thing?
So there's a lot of reasons why. Overall, I mean, I think it is the changing chemistry of water. It is making life in the ocean more difficult, right? Mm-hmm. So it's making shellfish, it is making the process of them growing and developing and maturing much more difficult, which then has a cascading issues with the fish that eat them and the fish that eat them and the people that eat fish. So there's a real food security issue, but it's also just fundamentally changing the ocean chemistry, making it harder for organisms and those ecosystems to survive. Now, we don't really like this terminology, but in the layman's terms, because ocean acidification is a very technical process to deconstruct, people have referred to ocean acidification as climate change's evil twin brother, or
climate change's evil twin brother. I like that.
Or, and the scientists are probably cringing because it's far more complex than that. But basically, you know, when you put an excess of carbon emissions in the atmosphere, you're not just fundamentally changing, you know, what is happening in our air, you're fundamentally changing what is happening in our seas and our ocean.
Well, I didn't know that. So right there, this is worth the cost of admission to the podcast. Thank you.
Well, it's crazy because the ocean is actually acidifying faster today than at any point on the human record, and is projected, scientists believe, that today the ocean is 30% more acidic than it was just 200 years ago. And so you're basically just creating conditions that make it harder for organisms to grow, to mature, and for ecosystems to survive. And ocean acidification and coral bleaching are often linked together. So this is having dramatically devastating effects on our ecosystems, and particularly on the shellfish industry. And so it's a food security issue, it's a livelihood issue, it's an ecosystem issue, and it's one that is very difficult if you're not monitoring your waters or understanding that. And not every scientific institution around the world has the ability to have the equipment to monitor that. And so that's part of what the Ocean Foundation works on, is building that capacity. So in order to address it, you first can understand it by monitoring it. There is a legislative component to this as well, because there's real legislative prescriptions that get at strategies for proper management and stewardship that both mitigate the issue, but also help us adapt to what's already happening.
Okay, so I understand the Ocean Foundation now, which I don't. I'm also going to commend its founders for coming up with such a perfect name for it. You know, the Ocean Foundation. If you wanted to trademark that today, you couldn't. So it's good to be an early adopter of good things. And what is Project Seagrass Grow, and how does that fit into the Ocean Foundation?
Great. So, as I mentioned, you know, we have this unique hybrid model where we host projects. We also host donor advice services. So we weren't seeded with some massive endowment, right? We're a public foundation. Every dollar we give out, we raise ourselves. That's part of being a public foundation. But in addition to running these donor advised services and these philanthropic services and hosting these projects, we run our own core initiatives. So one of them that is mentioned is our international ocean acidification work. The other one is on blue carbon. And so this—
Blue carbon. What is blue? I love it, but what is it? Blue carbon.
Right. So we're going to get into this. So coastal wetlands, this is basically the carbon sequestration process that happens in coastal wetlands. And so we house this under what the Ocean Foundation calls the Blue Resilience Initiative. And we started investigating this really in 2008 because, you know, in the early 2000s, you probably heard a lot of things like cap and trade, right?
Yes.
And so
this was to set up markets where corporations could trade credits in initiatives to limit carbon?
Exactly. And John McCain and Russ Feingold even, I think, sponsored some legislation on it together. It didn't pass, but it was introduced. And so this was really a way where we said, okay, we know we have to curb carbon emissions. What is the theory was, what do the people creating the carbon emissions, what do these corporations care most about? Money. So if we actually put a price on their carbon emissions, we set a limit that says, we're not saying you can't pollute. We're just saying, if you pollute over this amount, you got to pay for it. You got to pay for it. And the idea was that by actually tying it to the purse, that maybe it would reduce that kind of behavior. And so there was a bunch of different cap and trade schemes. And ultimately, I don't think that it ever really matured in the way that the advocates for those systems had intended. But what started to emerge in the early 2000s was the carbon marketplace. And so traditionally, even today, the carbon marketplace is filled with carbon sequestration projects aimed at offsetting a footprint. And they're mostly based terrestrially, so on land, like forestry projects, so planting trees, or they're done on things like methane gas capture, where you're basically capturing that carbon out of the air and you're storing it mostly underground. And so we recognize that we need a full suite of carbon sequestration tools in the toolbox, right? We are
polluting. We being planet Earth, or we being
planet Earth,
the ocean
society.
Planet Earth, okay.
Humans, the Ocean Foundation, all of us walking on God's green earth, or as I've now learned coming to the ocean world, God's blue marble, whatever you want to call it, right? We need a suite of tools, right? So we certainly encourage all strategies that can be unveiled, because we're polluting at alarming rate, right? Bill McKibben's organization, he literally named his group 350.org, because years ago he said, if we exceed 350 parts per million in the atmosphere, it's the point of no return. We're well over 400 parts per million.
We're over 400 now?
Well over. I mean, I don't know where it is exactly today, but we've been over 400 parts per million for a while. So The point is that we need as many tools in the toolbox as possible. But one tool that we felt was not being investigated was blue carbon, specifically using tidal wetlands, these coastal ecosystems, to sequester carbon. Now, why is that?
I'm going to interrupt you for a second, Jason, because the light bulb just went off over my head. So I'm out here in the Hamptons, and I'm looking out on my driveway where I have a sailboat that I bought this year. It's a 25-foot blue racing trimaran, and I haven't come up with a name for it yet. Now I got it. Blue carbon.
Well, you're going to have to offset your footprint then.
No, it's a sailboat, you know, it only uses the wind. There is no footprint to offset.
Well, yeah, there's always some footprint. We'll help you calculate that. That's a good segue because when we started investigating this in 2008, this led us to realize nobody knows what their footprint is. What the hell does that even mean, right? So in 2012, we actually came out with the first ever carbon calculator for the individual. It's intentionally simplistic because you could get very sophisticated. And for private companies, we will do the service for them where you're taking into consideration their supply lines, their, you know, employees' commute time. Like literally, you can calculate every kind of piece of that. But we didn't want to make it overly complex or over-engineered because we didn't want the point of entry to participate to be too burdensome. So this calculator, you go online, this is Seagrass Grow calculator. That Seagrass Grow is branded for this program, and I'll explain why. But it just asks you a couple of questions if you're taking a trip. You know, what mode of transportation, how many miles, maybe there's a few questions on diet and housing, and it tells you what your projected carbon footprint is, and then you can actually pay to offset that carbon footprint. And then those monies are used to fund restoration projects. Let me take a step back, though, and talk about why we focused on blue carbon. So for us, blue carbon really means in the type of species and the type of ecosystems, when we say blue carbon, for us, we're really talking about salt marshes, seagrasses, and mangroves.
Why?
Well, those are the ones that we focus the most on, and mostly because they have what we refer to as additional co-benefits.
Co-benefits. What's that?
Co-benefits. So if you do methane gas capture, remarkable at sequestering that carbon, but that's it. There are no additional benefits to enhancing biodiversity. You didn't do any habitat restoration, probably didn't increase livelihoods. There's no additional co-benefits. If you plant an acre of seagrass, a single acre of seagrass may support as many as 40,000 fish and 50 million small invertebrate like crabs, oysters, and mussels.
50 million in 1 acre?
In 1 acre.
Holy cow.
Seagrasses occupy 0.1% of the ocean seafloor, so 0.1%. Yet they are responsible for about 11% of all the organic carbon buried in the ocean. And they help mitigate the effects of ocean acidification. So in addition to seagrasses and mangroves' incredible ability to sequester carbon, in fact, mangroves, and these estimates vary on who you ask, but conservatively, mangroves sequester at least 10 times more carbon than a tree in the Amazonian rainforest. So their ability to sequester carbon is greater. Also, the threat of re-releasing carbon is reduced. And here's what I mean. When someone gives you an estimate of how to offset your carbon footprint, those are projections based on 50 to 100 years. In other words, if you say, my carbon footprint is X, here's the number of trees you need to plant to offset my carbon footprint. It's not like you plant the tree today and your footprint is sequestered tomorrow.
That tree's got to grow.
That tree's got to grow. And most of these projections, particularly on the certified marketplace, are based over 100 years, meaning that tree's got to live there for 100 years, undisturbed, sequestering carbon. If that tree gets cut down, if that tree dies, that tree burns, it is going to re-release that carbon back into the atmosphere. Mm. Not all of the carbon it had, but the carbon it had remaining in it. And therefore, it hasn't fully offset your footprint. The chances of that are dramatically reduced with blue carbon, because what happens is that seagrasses actually store this into their root structure. And if you ever look at a mangrove, the thick biomass that they have, they're actually storing.
Oh, I'm a flats fisherman. I've spent more hours than I want to admit in there looking at mangroves.
And so you also know then, looking at this tangled root structures, these tangled gardens of the sea, as we like to call them, are great for habitats, right? And so they're great for fish nurseries. They're great for protection of animals. Here's the other thing that is really important. Where do these species live? Where do mangroves thrive most? On these coastal ecosystems, particularly in the Caribbean. What are the islands in the Caribbean facing right now? The effects of climate change. So mangroves and seagrasses are actually, in addition to sequestering carbon, which is helpful to mitigate the effects of climate change, they're also the first line of defense to help dissipate wave energy, help break up storms on shore, and protect against flooding. In fact, there are insurance companies that are actively looking at if they can reduce people's premiums for flood insurance if you have mangroves on your property. I mean, that's how scientific they've gotten at these flood mitigation benefits.
So let me talk football for a minute.
All right.
Will you indulge me?
Yes.
So I find this fascinating, the difference between planting a tree in the Amazon and growing, planting seagrass and additional mangrove structures along the coastline. In popular culture, that I'm aware of, certainly in the boating industry, is a story involves Tom Brady and Gisele Brady. And he just bought a really nice Dutch-built yacht, which is my specialty. And investigating that, I found that Gisele, who I believe is a supermodel or an actress, I'm not big on this, is actually running a huge reforestation project in the Amazon in Brazil. Can you repeat again the relative merits between planting an acre of seagrass and planting a tree in the Amazon?
Sure. Let me just say, though, we are very pro protecting the Amazon and rehabilitating the Amazon to the extent that it needs to be. And so, though, like I said, we advocate for a full suite of tools.
Oh, it's not, I'm sure it's not a zero-sum game, you know, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just as like we use the reference in the Amazon because that's just what most people recognize. But a mangrove is going to sequester at least 10 times more carbon than a terrestrial tree, a tree in the Amazonian rainforest or a tree anywhere for that matter. It's just its carbon storage ability is far greater than that of other tree species.
I mean, and you're doing this now in the Caribbean?
Yes, we are. So our flagship project is in Puerto Rico, particularly in Hobos Bay. And this is really important for a couple of reasons. So September 2017, Hurricane Maria, and really both Hurricanes Irma and Maria rocked Puerto Rico. They also rocked St. Croix. If you would permit me just saying for a moment, because we also have partners in St. Croix, this is something that... you know, I don't know if it's the Lin-Manuel Miranda effect or what. Everyone knew that Puerto Rico was affected. Doesn't mean that Puerto Rico got the aid that it needed, and it certainly didn't. But everyone knew that Puerto Rico was affected, and it's like nobody paid attention to St. Croix or any of the other islands in the Caribbean that were also affected. So just while we're talking now, let me just point that out, that they were also rocked by this. But JetBlue Airways, one of our partners, is the major airline carrier in the Caribbean. And they really wanted to do something to respond because not only does this affect their business, but it, you know, they have employees that live in the area. I mean, as a company, they really care about this region. And so they launched a 100 by 35 campaign, which was 100 direct actions in the first 35 days of the aftermath of the hurricane. One of those actions that they wanted to do was on habitat restoration and overall environmental protection and sustainability. And so they reached out to the Ocean Foundation. We had already been a partner of theirs working on a variety of different issues. And they said, you know, can you bring your Seagrass Grow program here? And for us, there are really three things that are critically important. One is obviously it has to be the right ecosystem, right? You have to be prescribing the right type of species of seagrass and mangroves to, you know, the right ecosystem.
And yeah, it has to work. It has to work. Yeah.
That passed that first test. Second, there has to be a community willing to work with you. And you need to bring in the technical expertise or harness the local expertise that's there. And then the third is that there has to be an official partnership with either the local government or local municipality, because one thing, and this is something that we really want to raise the alarm bell on, that we feel like does not get talked about enough with carbon sequestration projects, is long-term monitoring. So people are really good at picking a location. They raise the money. They give these fancy presentations. They launch the project. And then nobody stays there for the next 50 years to monitor and steward that work. For us, we could not do this work if we didn't have a relationship with the Hobos Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve. It is a NOAA federally designated research reserve, which means it already has staff that are there to monitor and conserve and protect this area. There's already a level of protections in this area. And so we couldn't do this without their partnership, their blessing, their permitting, their approval. So that is also something to be, I think the most important takeaway is no nonprofit organization, particularly one that doesn't live on an island every day, can really do this work effectively unless you're working hand in hand with a local community organization.
And it sounds also working closely with corporate efforts. This linkage with JetBlue, I think, is amazing.
Yeah, it has been. And I think we've engaged other you know, corporate entities to get involved. Like, so Columbia Sportswear actually donates a significant amount of in-kind equipment and apparel to help us outfit some of our in-the-field workers when we're out doing some of this restoration work. I mean, so there's different ways that companies can engage.
Well, let me talk about these two companies in a row because they're close to my heart here. So first, I wear Columbia products when I'm fly fishing. But more to the point, it was maybe 14, 16 months ago when I read the press release that JetBlue was committing to being carbon neutral within, I think it was 6 or 8 years. And this is a company that must burn 20 million gallons a year of jet fuel. And I found that just astounding. And it was that press release that got me thinking, what can I do? And it was that JetBlue initiative that led me to come up with this carbon neutral yacht ownership program. So it's just great to see corporations. You know, I went to high school with Spike Lee back in Brooklyn. I'm older than you are. So the phrase that I always use, it's just great to see these corporations, you know, doing the right thing. This is very exciting.
And for us, that's really, you know, we don't really care how people get there as long as they get there, right? The Ocean Foundation is, you know, we've been described as stubborn, but smart as hell. And that's sort of a mantra we like.
I would like to be described that way.
I would like to be, yeah, personally. I don't have that moniker as a person. That's just our organizational
reputation. Me either.
Like we do think very nuanced about these issues. We try and fill a very specific niche. But, you know, at the same time, it's like we have high values for how we hold ourselves accountable. So we don't really care if people get to the issue as long as that we don't compromise those values. People got to get there. And that's part of, I think, being an effective conservation organization is everyone's always saying, you know, you got to meet people where they're at. Even on an issue like as complicated as ocean acidification, it's like, okay, how do you meet people where they're at and not just discredit them because, you know, they're not fully entrenched in the issue in the way that we are. I think that's one of the things I'm very grateful about even talking to you today and utilizing this podcast is that the environmental community is a pretty insular bubble. The ocean bubble is a bubble within a bubble. Mm-hmm. And I find that oftentimes, you know, you can go to 5 meetings and realize you went to a meeting and everyone just followed you right there. I mean, you look around, it's the same people over and over and over again. And so
That's interesting. This is a question that I've been thinking about all week. How do you get the word out?
Well, this is one of the things that we love about the Seagrass Grow program because it has, I think, one of the easiest barriers of entry. You know, people come to us to talk about offsetting their carbon footprint, but that's very rarely what they leave with, right? They may come saying, oh, you know, I'm taking the family on a vacation and I realize I can offset my footprint for $20 a ton. You know, it's going to cost me $80 to offset this trip. You know, let me do that. That's very rarely where it ends. What happens is it then piques their interest it gives us a venue to talk about these issues on a deeper level. I will tell you, it is very hard in today's society with the attention spans that we have. And, you know, you have 15 seconds on social media and most people aren't even watching the thing with sound, right? So it's like, how do you get the image and draw them in? We believe that there is value to that, but we also believe in having substance to the conversation. And maybe it's not about how wide you go, but how deep you go. That is something that I think we're actually wrestling with. You know, should we be digging in deeper with the community we have, or should we be figuring out maybe how to expand it? And I think the answer is we have to do both.
Well, let me tell you how I found you, how I found Seagrass Grow in the Ocean Foundation. And I think it's a happy story and a sad story. So JetBlue inspired me to come up with this carbon neutral yacht ownership the fog warning, my company, will offset the carbon put into the environment by the owners of yachts that I sell every year for as long as they own their boat, new or used. So I had the idea, but then I had to decide what programs, where will this money flow, right? What carbon neutral programs can I support on behalf of my clients? So I Googled sort of ocean related carbon sequestration programs, and there were none. Yours was the only one I could find.
Yeah, now we're getting into the good stuff. Yes.
So this is why I ask, how can you get the word out? How can you look? I'm trying to jumpstart something in my industry. I'm just one guy, but every boat dealer, every boat manufacturer should do what I'm doing. And I'm trying to get that word out. How are you getting the word out so you can expand, you can leverage your impact?
I think one of the most important factors to this, and why when you did that search for ocean-based, you know, carbon offsetting projects, yeah, there really weren't many, and that is the issue of certification.
What is that?
So certification is what allows a carbon offsetting project to be monetized, go on the carbon marketplace, be bought, sold, traded. Today, there are no certified seagrass projects in the world, and there are very, very, very few blue carbon certified projects. And in fact, the first certified blue carbon project and the first certified seagrass project is being worked on as we speak in Virginia. And so why is that? Well, first of all, this industry is new. People have not really invested in blue carbon, one, because it's really expensive. So if you put up basically a tree plantation, right, if you just clear cut a bunch of land, plant a bunch of trees, very inexpensive, right? Very, very inexpensive. And so you can do methane gas capture or even some forestry projects at $5 a ton, $10 a ton, $15 a ton, where blue carbon is anywhere from $20 to $50 a ton, because it is so much more labor intensive, costly to complete. It requires much more technical expertise. So that is why we decided to focus on it, because we do believe that getting these projects certified, and we believe that our project in Puerto Rico is on path to be certified in 3 to 5 years and will be the largest certified blue carbon project in the Caribbean. So we believe in that, and that's why we've been investing, but it takes years for this to happen. And the reason there's not certification is because right now the cost of certification is twice as much as the project itself.
What will it cost to certify your Puerto Rico project?
Well, it's a modality of scale. So I don't have a particular number because it's about the size of the project. So sure. How much we're able to complete, that's what they're going to have to go out and certify. But we're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's not an inexpensive process. And so,
well, then I better sell a lot of boats, because I want to specifically, if I can do this, specifically direct as many resources as I can to this certification issue, because it seems to me once you're certified, you greatly leverage the size of your program. So there's a great force multiplier here through certification.
Absolutely. And so right now, you know, it's internal verification of carbon sequestration. So people, when they offset with us, are not buying a carbon credit. It's a charitable contribution, $20 a ton. Now, once we bring it online as certification, all the work we've previously done, we will treat as retired credits, meaning we won't double count that work. We'll only count new work. And this is the pathway to certification, but you have to invest in it philanthropically to get the infrastructure, get the permits, do the actual work, so that there's a project large enough worth certifying. And that's what we're doing right now.
You know, you are, I'll use the you in the royal sense, you're a man with a plan. I mean, you guys really seem to have connected policy with practice to really map out the next 5, 10 years of what you want to do.
Well, that's the goal. On our good days, I think we, but, you know, it is just worth saying, like, this is, it's a new space. It's a developing space. And we also, it's a community of practice, you know, folks like the Smithsonian Institute and IUCN and, you know, a variety of other people have really helped us, first developing the literature and the science about what these ecosystems can do. And now they've even been elevated to, you know, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, right? So the UN has these 17 Sustainable Development Goals. And then, you know, parallel to that is the Paris Climate Agreement, which the US just rejoined. In that framework is something called NDCs, these nationally determined contributions. It's basically, what are you as a country going to do to contribute to the overall solution? And there's even things where countries are writing in mangroves and other blue carbon emissions in their NDCs as part of the global solution. So this is, we're not the only ones working on it. It is a community of practice, but it is very exciting. And I'm telling you right now, this podcast, I think, you know, your coverage of this is probably going to live well 5-10 years from now, because blue carbon is sort of, people like, what is this? This is new. 10 years from now, it's going to be what conservationists are investing in the most. I really, truly believe that.
Well, and blue carbon is also the new name of my sailboat.
I like that. We'll take that.
So I have, I'm lucky to have, 10,000. I'm averaging about 10,000 new readers a year to the Fog Warning blog. Now I've got the podcast. Two closing questions for today. Are there any questions that I didn't ask? And what are your closing thoughts that you'd like my readers and listeners to take away?
I think it's easy to be pessimistic, right? 2020 was a rough year. And I think when we talk about the issue of climate, I often feel people, I can feel it, you know, as I'm talking to them, being overwhelmed, right? Because we're talking about, you know, changing the energy grid and fundamentally changing how we produce the products that are made and turn our lights on, and radically changing our economy and how we become more resilient to the effects of climate change. And some of those effects are already here now, real and present. And so I feel people get immediately overwhelmed. And I think that's where we lose a lot of people. It's not that people don't care. It's just, there's so much information that is in such a doomsday scenario that I think people almost feel, okay, what can I actually do about it?
Mm-hmm.
I think with our program, the Seagrass Grow, this is about individual accountability. It's about individual action. It's about saying, this is what you as an individual or as a company or as a community can do to take responsibility for your own footprint that you're putting out into the world. You don't have to be responsible for everybody else. You just have to be responsible for yourself. And so I think ultimately that's what this program is intended to do. It's intended to support these really critical projects that will benefit the whole of society and these local communities in the Caribbean. But more important, it's to help you as an individual be aware of what your footprint is. And one of the best things we've seen with companies is not more money going into the Seagrass Grow program, it's actually less, because once they've monetized their carbon footprint and began to track it, they decided to change for the better and reduce it, which is ultimately the goal, to reduce the carbon footprint in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a nonprofit organization. We need as many resources as possible. But if somebody is paying us less in this program because they're reducing their carbon footprint, that is success in our minds. So I just think that's the takeaway, utilizing this program to take control over your own individual carbon footprint.
Well, let's revisit this on an annual basis at least. I am getting very good press on this initiative and on this partnership with Seagrass Grow. The more boats that I sell, the more funds that will flow towards Seagrass Grow. And let's have an annual little conference and see how you're doing and I'm doing and we're doing. How's that?
I would love that, Dave. That'd be great.
All right, Jason. Thank you for your time today.
Yes, thank you so much.
I hope you've enjoyed this inaugural episode of the Fog Warning Podcast half as much as we enjoyed producing it for you. Please subscribe to the podcast to be regularly updated with new episodes. I can pretty much guarantee a good time will be had by all.